started the audio stream already.
Oh, thank you.
And, in a few minutes, I will start the video connection.
Okay. Wow, you make it so easy. You've been doing it long enough, huh?
Yeah.
I think when I came here like 20 years ago, you were here.
Well, this is hopefully the last time that they use the courtroom for this. They're going to remodel and move, remodel our bench and then have court over there. So
can you show me where that is?
Certainly can.
Okay. Is it in this, it's in this building, right?
Yeah, it's over by our office, clerk's office.
Oh, okay.
Nobody comes. We did check our mic levels this morning and they seem to be okay, so.
Oh, good.
Kwame tested it out.
You know, prepared for court, I had so many other things to do, and court was like a side thing for me. I totally forgot to call San Francisco and ask them to send those relics. I did. Oh, wow. I can't believe it.
It's all right. Worked out.
Yeah, it worked out. Thanks to you.
Randy in white. Pretty good. Just to let you know, I'm going to be dialing in.
Morning.
Oh,
Yeah, Tom Hupper for the New York case.
Great.
Thank you very much.
First.
Okay, and we're gonna be the first class?
Yes, it's gonna be the first matter, so we'll have, yeah, you guys are first on calendar. Okay, thanks a lot. Bye.
Are you first on the calendar, sir?
I am. You know, you might wanna sit on this side, because we're gonna have.
Oh, yeah, thanks, yes.
Yeah, we're gonna have them, you know, I know that this is your proper side, but.
Right.
Thank you very much.
And so I'm not gonna be able to see, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, because last time I was here, they had a, I thought they had one patient both ways, but.
Yeah.
I lean way over, I can see like the corner.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I might be able to get some. Let's see. It helps you to see him.
It does, huh?
Keep going, they're gonna keep going. Well, this is only my second and tenth circuit, they said. You're done? Okay.
Hey, good morning.
Brandon, how you doing?
Pretty good. Nice to see you. I'm gonna have to kinda play with the microphone.
Okay.
Only because I have only one microphone, and so I'm gonna try and find the best place that we can put it for you.
Alright.
So. I'm gonna guess a couple places.
Right now, you sound great.
First, though.
Okay.
First, I'll add on the order a little bit, because it's a video conference, so.
Oh, yeah.
This is where you can see the picture.
Right.
And if you have to make any adjustments, like, this down, and then it's facing the unit.
Right.
The picture-in-picture disappears, you see.
Oh.
If you put it down.
Sideways.
Then you.
Hey, good morning, John.
Okay, and volume is plainly marked, so.
Yeah, and that and the mute button are probably all you're getting mute.
Okay, John, testing one, two, three, how do you pick me up here?
It's pretty good, I guess I should ask.
Could be a smidge louder.
Let me crank you up on my end a little bit.
Okay. Testing one, two, three, testing one, two, three.
Hold on. Can you try again, Randall?
Okay, testing one, two, three, testing one, two, three.
Do a little bit more, alright.
Testing one, two, three, testing one, two, three. Testing one, two, three. Okay.
It'll probably be better once, I assume there's not gonna be anybody else talking at the time, so.
Right.
That should help.
Right. And what I'll do is, I'm gonna have the attorney here. I have the microphone right now at the podium. And so if we find out that when the judges are speaking and asking questions of your attorney, if it's a little bit too light, what I'll do is I'll move the microphone closer to where the judges are.
Okay.
Okay?
And just to say something, can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can hear you perfectly fine.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Can you do an audio check from the other two chairs?
Certainly. Testing one, two, three, testing one, two, three.
Yeah,
okay.
That's fine.
Okay.
Hey, what is all this?
Testing one, two, three, testing one, two, three. Mic check.
Alright.
Okay, great. Thank you, John.
Sounds good.
And so we'll get underway in 20 minutes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we're about 20 minutes out.
Okay.
Great, thank you.
Well, you'll just leave this up, leave the connection open then, right?
Yes, I'll just mute mine if you mute yours, I'll move it away.
Okay.
Thank you.
Alright, thanks for sharing.
Yeah, cool.
You know, what can I tell them that they don't already know about me?
Yeah, that's right.
So, but I'm
video conference.
Real last anyway.
She's planning on it before she creates. So she, yeah, I know.
Do you know if the last case got 30 minutes?
It did.
Kevin Sumida. Kevin Sumida. I just need you to check in with me.
Sorry.
I
guess we're on both sides.
Is the audio?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
What's that? Mm-hmm. You know, it would be on if it was this way. Oh, there I am.
All right.
Good morning and welcome to the Ninth Circuit. First two cases this morning are submitted on the briefs, United States versus Sun and United States versus Manglona. So our first case for argument is by video, and that is Munoz versus England. An appellant is participating by video. So we're happy to be in Hawaii. We're sorry that you're not, but you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Stephen Spiegel, representing Saro Munoz. This case is about the congressionally mandated goal of eliminating employment discrimination through voluntary settlements and the role of the federal courts, district courts, in enforcing those settlements. Plaintiff submits that the district court made findings of fact which are unsupported or contrary to the evidence in the record, and that the legal conclusions are contrary to the controlling law on summary judgment and federal common law on enforcement of settlements. Accordingly, the grant of summary judgment to the Naval Base should be reversed and the case should be remanded for trial. Mr. Munoz has been a weapons technician at the Naval Repair Ship Facility in Japan since 1987. Over the course of time, the Navy has phased out the aging missile and rocket systems, which Mr. Munoz was the lead technician for maintaining, and replaced them with the modern vertical launch missile system, referred to by the acronym as the VLS missile system, which is currently in use and has been being used since the 1990s. However, while the Navy modernized its weapon systems, his supervisors refused to provide Mr. Munoz with the training required by their own training regulations and by the position description written by the Navy to provide him with the training to keep up to date with the corresponding weapon systems.
Counsel, this is Judge Rawlinson.
Yes, Your Honor.
I have a question. Are you seeking to enforce the predetermination settlement agreement on behalf of your client?
Yes, we are.
So I have a question as to whether or not there is subject matter jurisdiction in federal court over such an agreement.
I understand the court wanted us to address that. I'd be glad to turn to that now if you'd like. In particular, the court asked that we address the 10th Circuit case of Lindstrom versus the United States. And with all respect to the 10th Circuit, that court did not address the current Ninth Circuit law, nor the reasoning provided consistent with other circuits as well as the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has held that cooperation and voluntary compliance through settlements are the congressionally preferred means of assuring the quality of employment opportunities by eliminating discriminatory practices.
This Judge Hawkins, counsel, has the Supreme Court addressed the issue that Judge Rawlinson is referring to, that is whether breach of a predetermination settlement agreement, there is subject matter jurisdiction in the federal courts?
The Supreme Court didn't address it directly, but indirectly on the subject of settlement agreements being preferred means for redressing this. And the Supreme Court addressed that in a decision in Alexander versus Gardner Denver Company in 1974. The Ninth Circuit in Blank versus Donovan likewise addressed that Supreme Court case in holding that EEO settlements are enforceable.
Was that a predetermination settlement agreement?
I believe it was, in Blank, in the Ninth Circuit case.
What, how do you square your position with the regulation that talks about the complainant being able to ask for an agreement to be enforced. But that, if that doesn't turn out, basically you reinstate the claim processing as opposed
to... I don't believe that's what the regulation states. The regulation states 29 CFR 1614.504A provides that the employee make a choice of remedies to either seek to enforce the agreement, or they have the choice of starting de novo with the underlying claims that were settled. The regulations go on, including subsection B of 504, that, well, an important part of the 504 process is the employee has to notify the agency with whom the settlement was with that they believe there's a breach, and give that agency the opportunity to either implement the agreement, redress the breach, or state its reasons. And none of those obligations were fulfilled by the Navy in this case, which is the root of the problem. But 504B provides that if the employee's not satisfied with the agency's addressing or lack of addressing the breach, then the employee may file what they call an appeal, which is actually an enforcement action, to the commission. If the employee is then not satisfied with the commission's resolution of it, the employee is issued a right to sue letter to proceed to federal district court. That's been the policy for almost 20 years, and it's been consistently applied by the commission.
Does that happen with respect to the items covered by the predetermination settlement agreement?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the second word. Is that what?
Has what you just described happened with respect to the matters covered by the predetermination settlement agreement?
Yes, Mr. Munoz fully complied with the exhaustion requirements.
He has a right to sue letter from the EEOC to enforce a breach of the settlement agreement?
He had the right to sue letter to proceed to court after the commission reviewed the question of the breach.
I'm not being clear or you're not listening. Let me try it again. Has the EEOC issued your client a right to sue letter covering his claim that the settlement agreement has been breached?
I believe the answer is yes.
Where is that?
It says the right to sue.
Where is that in the record?
I don't have that in front of me, but it's clearly in the record, and it's certainly in the complaint, and it's in the jurisdictional statement in the opening brief.
But doesn't the right to sue letter cover his complaint of employment discrimination? In other words, it circles back to the statute and the regulations, which relate to the complaint on the employment discrimination, not to the settlement.
There's no reason to interpret it that way.
Well, there is a reason to interpret it that way because if you read the word complaint as it's used in the regulations, you have to ask yourself, well, complaint about what? And it's not just the complaint, like, I have a complaint against you, I don't like this. It's a complaint in the legal sense. So I think that the question we're struggling with is that this complaint in the legal sense seems to be grounded on a complaint of employment discrimination, which is different than a suit on a contract.
The choice of remedy is given to the employee in 1614, 504A, and 504B. Once the employee makes the choice that he wishes to enforce a settlement agreement and seeks review from the commission, that's what he gets to proceed de novo in federal district court on. I would argue that it would be inappropriate if he sought to enforce the agreement to then start all over again in federal district court. He already made his choice. But certainly he has that choice. I would also call your attention to these, what I refer to here as the supplemental memo that was filed on Friday, which had originally been filed in February, I believe 22nd, 2008, which addresses these issues, and in particular, the district court in Kraft versus Johans had addressed these issues as well, and determined that the other circuit courts as well have determined it would be antithetical to Congress's strong commitment to conciliation if there was no federal forum for enforcement of conciliation agreements. The Fourth Circuit case.
May I ask you on the regulation 1614.504B, it talks about if a complainant is not satisfied that the settlement agreement has been complied with, then the issue goes to the commission for determination.
That's correct.
And so that happened, that happened in this case? That there was,
yes, it did.
Okay. And then you're saying that the right to sue letter you got from the commission was as a result of the commission's determination regarding the allegation that the settlement agreement had not been complied with?
The commission, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. There was really a procedural morass in this case created by the Navy. The commission first in 2005 reviewed the settlement agreement, found that the Navy had not yet complied but still had time to comply, that the agreement, the key terms, career enhancing training, were ambiguous, and that several key terms were not yet defined, and remanded it to the Navy to report back and do a preliminary investigation. That process repeated in different iterations. It became quite a mess. We asked the commission to take hold and provide a briefing schedule, and instead they issued an opinion without us ever having an opportunity to be heard. So the second time they wrote that any training would do, which was exactly the same ruling, the opposite of the ruling that they had issued just a year earlier.
So I guess the
not
short
being
answer
satisfied
is,
with that result,
is the short answer
that,
no,
that included a right to sue letter.
Is the short answer no, that the EEOC did not give you a letter, a right to sue letter, on the assertion that the settlement agreement had been breached? Instead, you got
no, the EEOC, the answer is yes, the EEOC did give notice of a right to sue.
Well,
on the settlement.
So did the EEOC said that the Navy was in compliance, correct?
The second time, you could interpret it that way, yes.
Well, that's what we're looking at here. So then you don't go to 1614.504C because the agency didn't determine, the commission didn't determine that the agency was not in compliance, which is subpart C. Instead, they determined that the agency was in compliance, and the regulation then doesn't tell you anything specific about what happens there other than you proceed with your lawsuit, correct?
That's correct.
But then you have a contract action against the United States where you have to get into a sovereign immunity potential waiver of sovereign immunity question, which is it's a quirk with the Navy. It wouldn't happen if this was, you know, the Bank of Hawaii or someone else. So how do you square the contract action against the Navy here where there's not any waiver of immunity?
Well, I would respectfully disagree that it's not a contract action. It's still an action to enforce the settlement. When the
We may or may not disagree with you on that, but you might want to reserve. You only have 2 minutes left, and I wondered if you wanted to reserve that for rebuttal.
I thought I had 3 minutes left, but I was going to reserve it for rebuttal.
Well, I'm looking at the digital clock, so that's my only. So we'll reserve that for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the court, Thomas A. Helper on behalf of the defendants. On the issue of subject matter jurisdiction, I have to say I found myself persuaded by the district court's opinion that it did in fact have very limited subject matter jurisdiction over the breach of settlement agreement claim and the claim that the denial of training itself was a act of retaliation. I don't believe that the right to sue letter is in fact in the either the excerpts of record or the supplemental excerpts of record. And I have to confess that I've not looked at it in quite a while here. My recollection is that it did in fact cover both those issues.
But it did or did not?
It did.
It covered the retaliation issue as well as the underlying discrimination issue.
That is my recollection, but I think it would be appropriate for the parties to supplement the record with that document.
Well, I guess I know that you might agree with the district court, but I assume you would also agree that we have an obligation de novo to take a look at subject matter jurisdiction.
Yes.
So I think this is, seems to be an odd case if you look at the regulation 1614.504, because as counsel just said, in the end, the commission said the training was fine, in effect,
yes,
on the second round. And the regulation talks about what would happen if the agency was not in compliance. And it doesn't talk about what would happen if the commission said the agency was in compliance. So where does that leave us in terms of the jurisdictional basis for this lawsuit?
I think that, as the district court found, that if you look at 504 in isolation, there's no waiver of sovereign immunity there, and that you do have to look more broadly at the purposes of the regulations and of the Title VII in general to find subject matter jurisdiction, and to find that given the remedial nature of Title VII and the purpose and the broad view this court has taken as well of Title VII, that when you read the regulation in its entirety and you look at the remedies available, when you get when a complainant gets an adverse decision from the EEO, I'm sorry, from the EEOC, and then has the opportunity to take that up to the Office of Federal Operations, and then the office, an adverse decision from the OFO is in fact, there's an appeal to this court provided for in the regulations.
Where? Yeah, just help me out on that. So there it says the complainant can either ask that the terms be implemented or go ahead with the lawsuit. And if you say, I want the terms implemented, then it goes back to the agency to implement, correct?
He's talking about 405.
Are you on 504 or 405? What are you on?
He said 405.
405A, yes.
Okay. That's when the decision on appeal is the final decision, right?
Right. Yes. But I do think it is limited to the issues as 405 is limited to either specific performance or to reinstatement of the underlying EEO case, mm-hmm, which had to do with, actually, it had nothing to do with VLS training. It had to do with the fact that he couldn't go to certain training sessions called engineering working group sessions, that somebody insulted his son somehow, and that he had certain duties taken away, none of which were the VLS duties, which he in fact never had. So that would be what would be reinstated. But importantly, at oral argument before the district court, the plaintiff disclaimed any intention of proceeding with reinstatement of his charges and wanted only to have specific performance. In fact, he asked for a lot more than specific performance, but he certainly disclaimed reinstatement of the charges.
So, counsel, in this case, is it your recollection that the decision informed the complainant that he had a right to sue?
Yes.
On the settlement agreement?
That is my vague recollection, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask you a different way. Maybe this goes to sort of a mootness issue in an odd way, because if we agree with what I think is your interpretation, which is that the settlement agreement didn't specify any kind of specific training, and he did get training, he didn't get this particular training, but he did get other training, albeit beyond the, what, one-year period? So he has now received that training. Does that in a way make this case moot, or do we need to look at the merits of that argument?
I think you probably do have to look at the merits of the training. I mean, if we, you know, gave him useless training that had no effect on his career, then I think that you have to look at the training that was provided. But I think that the plaintiff did concede that training outside the one-year period did was career enhancing.
Well, we'll have to ask him, but I thought he conceded that, you know, that was still legitimate training and that this training did enhance his career. It's just that he still somehow thought that the VLS training was mandated by some aspect of his case.
Well, I think that the problem with the plaintiff's arguments is that there's really two separate claims here. There's a claim for a breach of contract, and there's a claim for retaliation. And plaintiff keeps blurring those two arguments. So if you look at the breach of contract argument separately, or that claim separately, there's no mental state to that. There's no motivation that you're looking at. We either complied with the settlement agreement or we didn't. It doesn't matter what the state of the mind of the decision maker was. And that's to the plaintiff's advantage. All he has to show is a breach, not a malicious breach. But if we complied with the settlement agreement, then that part of the analysis drops out of the picture, and this alleged promise, the parole evidence of an alleged promise to provide one particular kind of training, the VLS training, also drops out of the picture in addition to the district court's reasoning on parole evidence. So then you just have a straight Title VII retaliation McDonnell-Douglas case, and you look at the, did the Navy provide a reason for not giving him the particular training? It did. And has plaintiff overcome that argument or that assertion with specific and substantial evidence of retaliatory motive? He has not. As a matter of fact, if you look at this, the plaintiff's career, he really got a very extensive training that allowed him to substantially enhance his career, to stay in Japan, to do good work, and actually do it very well at his current job.
If we look at the breach of the settlement agreement as a contract claim, would the district court have jurisdiction over that in view of the fact that generally contract claims are heard in the court of claims? So how would the district court have jurisdiction to hear what has been described as a contract action pretty much universally?
Well, I think that then you have to look at the regulations as a waiver of sovereign immunity, as the district court did. I think that's the only way you could get to.
It wouldn't matter if there's a waiver of sovereign immunity if exclusive jurisdiction over contract claims is vested in the court of claims. It's not a waiver of immunity issue. It's the proper court.
No, that's correct.
Jurisdictional court. So how do we resolve that?
No, I think that's right. You'd have to say that if it's a straight breach of contract argument, that exclusive jurisdiction would be in the court of federal claims.
But, of course, the problem with that is that that court doesn't have equity jurisdiction for specific performance, does it?
Correct.
And therefore, and since this isn't a money claim but a specific
right.
performance yes. claim, then he would be out of luck if he ended up in the Court of Federal Claims.
And I'm hastily going back over my federal jurisdiction basic principles here, but I think that's right, that under the Little Tucker Act or under the Tucker Act that...
Yeah, he'd be in the Tucker Act in the Court of Federal Claims, being in the Little Tucker Act in the District Court, but there's no money.
Right. He's asking for specific performance, and that would be jurisdictionally appropriate. I did want to make one other important point that I think is not adequately addressed in my brief, and that has to do with the standard of review. The plaintiff is really, really pushing to have this court and the district court look beyond the four corners of the agreement to his career history, to this alleged promise, to all sorts of other things to determine what the meaning of career enhancing training is. And what he really wants with the parole evidence, he's arguing for, it's an ambiguous phrase, the career enhancing training phrase. He's really trying to supplement the record with an alleged agreement that directly contradicts the terms of the agreement. And the district court appropriately rejected that, and under the use of discretion standard of review, the court should confirm that ruling. But then the court went on to actually do exactly what the plaintiff wants, which is to look at the career history and some of the other things, and again determined that the career history, plaintiff's career history, his claims to be a career missile engineer, that that didn't help the plaintiff, that even if you look at exactly what the plaintiff wanted him to look at, that the district court found that the career-enhancing training phrase did not require VLS training. The standard of review for that is clearly erroneous, not de novo.
Was there a right to sue letter on the retaliation claim?
My recollection is that there was. But I just think we have to supplement the record with the right to sue letter, Your Honor.
Right. So probably there is a stronger basis for jurisdiction on the retaliation action than on the settlement agreement, because that's not a contract.
Right. It would be just a classic Title VII. You know, just if the settlement agreement had never existed and he asked for training, he didn't get it, that's arguably an adverse personnel action, so you go into the McDonnell Douglas.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Did you want to finish the thought?
No, I was moving on to a different thought.
Is there a difference in equal employment law between a settlement agreement entered into prior to a determination by the EEOC as opposed to one entered into after?
Under the reasoning, for the purposes of subject matter jurisdiction, Your Honor, I think there is not. I think that...
So the Fourth and the Tenth Circuits are just all wet in your view?
I wouldn't go that far. I think that given the perhaps more liberal jurisprudence of this court, that the district court appropriately determined that the district court decisions that he relied on or cited as persuasive precedent.
So you want us to create a circuit conflict?
I prefer, as I say, I'm persuaded by the district court's reasoning on this, and
I mean, it's a curious thing because, of course, you represent the Secretary of the Navy,
yes,
not the EEOC.
Yes.
Is this something that we ought to get the EEOC's view on, in your view?
Yes. I think it certainly would make sense.
Is there a practical difference when you drive these two complaints? So the second amended complaint had two counts, right?
Yes.
Count one said, we entered into a settlement agreement. You were supposed to provide me with training. You haven't done it. I want the agreement enforced. That's count one.
I think you've stated in a legally accurate way. I'm not sure that's exactly what count one says, but I think that you've done it.
That's the essence of it.
Yes.
Count two is, you withheld that training from me because of my prior complaints about age and racial discrimination, correct?
Yes.
Do they kind of bleed one into the other?
I think plaintiffs would very much like them to, but I don't think they should.
Well, in this sense, does a resolution of number two wipe out number one?
No, because
in other words, if at the end of the day, the highest court of competent jurisdiction looking at these two claims says, with respect to withholding training, the Navy has lived up to its obligations, period, full stop. Case is over, isn't it?
I think plaintiff, and again, I find myself oddly arguing against perhaps my own interest here, but I think that under the breach of settlement agreement, the entitlement to VLS training could have two sources. One is the settlement agreement, or some kind of an agreement that gives him a right that he wouldn't normally have as an employee.
Before I get too confused, is there a difference between these two counts with respect to the kind of training the plaintiff says he's entitled to?
No. He argues...
I didn't think so.
...for VLS training for both.
I didn't think so.
Your time has expired.
Could I answer?
You want to sum it up?
I just wanted to just address that point, the last point from because you're that if has, he also might have a claim independently as a retaliation claim, not from the arising from the settlement agreement, but just saying, hey, everybody gets this kind of training and you picked out me to retaliate against me, even if it's not a breach of the settlement agreement, is some independent obligation that the Navy had to provide him with.
Did he make that claim?
Well, I think that's implicit in his retaliation claim, but he certainly didn't provide any evidence that anybody else ever got this training, to the contrary.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Spiegel?
If I may, just briefly, with regard to the right to sue letter, in the opening brief at page 26, footnote 5, contains the citation to the published in Westlaw decision, which contains the right to sue provisions of the decision. With regard to the subject matter, I would point out in the Fourth Circuit case in Fram that specifically the Court of Claims found that it didn't have jurisdiction because over the breach of a settlement agreement, concluding that federal civil rights statutes are comprehensive and exclusive statutory scheme preempting the Court of Claims from having jurisdiction. And as the court in Kraft versus Johans determined, as had other circuits, it would be inimical to the civil rights scheme if there was no forum with to enforce the agreement. I would like to briefly point out that with regard to the second count, the retaliation claim, Mr. Munoz would have the full range of relief under the civil rights statutes in addition to any question of specific performance. And with regard to specific performance being not including damages, or if it includes damages, specific performance would include, since it was career enhancing, the probable promotion he would have gotten, and then the back pay and other items which are not specifically damages under federal civil rights law but are still part of the relief. And with regard, as we've addressed in the brief more specifically, the training that was provided was not career enhancing, as specifically required by his position description that it be extensive specialized training in his area of missile launcher technology, and that the Navy regulations require that it look to the not only immediate but the future needs, and that the Navy said they were going to have an 80% increase, and contrary to what his supervisor said, he still said he needed more vertical launch system missile technicians. His position description had been an issue, and as we addressed, his position description written by the supervisor, even after the settlement, still provided that 87% of his duties were for launcher technology.
Your time has expired. Do you have a closing remark you'd like to make?
Only that with regard to the agreement being ambiguous, in summary judgment, the Navy conceded the agreement was ambiguous and that we needed to go beyond four corners. The Commission found it ambiguous, and that this circuit in Pitts versus Nakamura has provided that when it's ambiguous, you look at the intent of the parties and you construe it against the party that drew up the agreement. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the citation on the right to sue letter as well. Thank both counsel for your argument. Munoz versus England is submitted, and we'll next hear argument in Kwok versus Frank.
May it please the court, my name is
Just a minute so everybody can get settled here. All right, please proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Todd Eddins. I am representing petitioner appellant. This is a 2254 habeas corpus petition. The defense theory at trial wasn't me. Everybody saw something, nobody saw everything. The evidence on the record shows that everybody did see something and everything, and it was pretty consistent that what everybody did see was an individual struggling with the victim shortly before the victim collapsed. The defense had one exculpatory witness. This one exculpatory witness knew what happened, saw what happened, and basically said that that struggling man inflicted the fatal injury to the victim in this case. This witness...
Is that not to manufacture this down too tightly, but is that what that witness would have said?
That witness... Which witness are we referring to? The exculpatory witness?
Yes.
The exculpatory witness would have said that the struggling individual basically with an elbow caused the fatal blow. Initially, that exculpatory witness told the police approximately a week later that from the incident that the that person that she alleges committed the crime kicked the victim. And that was the one reason in the deliberative process from counsel that she decided not to call this witness. So that was the primary reason, is she had two inconsistent theories about how that actual blow occurred.
Also, didn't she have Tanaka, who basically said he didn't testify in effect that there was a struggle. He just said, well, he was being held back because he thought that's what was happening. So she had more than just the problem with the conflicting testimony, didn't she?
When you say she, are you referring to
the
counsel?
Yeah.
Well, I think one aspect of her deliberative process, it was that her theory was the sole state witness, a guy named Torres, was not there. And she ran that theory throughout the case. And one reason why the exculpatory witness wasn't called was because she initially said that Torres was right there.
What about Lee?
Mr. Lee was an individual who apparently was right near the exculpatory witness. He did not, however, see, like everybody else, what actually happened.
But he said Torres was right there. I mean, he confirmed that Torres was right there at the site of the fight.
That's correct.
You wouldn't want him coming in. I mean, you know, she's kind of stuck there weaving her clients, what he's told her, and also what theory they're going to take, trying to uphold that. So I'm having some trouble understanding why not calling these witnesses was fatal, because it would have been fatal to her theory, and then she would have had no theory.
Let me just say that I don't think it was unreasonable not to call Mr. Lee. However, with respect to Ms. Ka'ai, the exculpatory witness, whatever she said, and just switching from kick to elbow, was still consistent with the defense theory that this guy didn't do it.
He didn't do it.
And that's the gist of it. I can see where it's probably, it was not necessarily unreasonable not to call Mr. Lee. But Ms. Ka'ai, who was a friend of the victim, actually visited him at the hospital that night, who presumably, you know, would have no motive to help the defendant out on trial, she was the one who would have provided the exculpatory.
But didn't the medical examiner say an elbow to the chest was not a viable theory in terms of causing death? And so maybe she didn't want a witness that would easily be contradicted by the medical testimony of record. So why would it be unreasonable to not subject your theory, to the medical examiner saying it's a crazy theory, and the medical examiner is going to have a great deal of weight with the jury? So why is it unreasonable to not take that chance?
What the medical examiner did say is this was an incredibly rare occurrence called commotio cordis. And what she did say was blunt force can cause that. The distinction from what the defense reviewed with the medical examiner was that elbow could not necessarily cause a fractured sternum. Now, that's where we get into the unreasonableness of counsel not consulting with an expert who could have supported the theory that the elbow could have caused a fractured sternum. That's the distinction. And that's why there's two aspects here. The counsel chose not to interview the exculpatory witness at trial because presumably the kick elbow inconsistency, and also chose not to consult with an expert who could have corroborated the exculpatory witness's testimony about the elbow strike.
Who was that expert?
The expert
that an elbow could break through the sternum and cause the injury.
At the motion for new trial, it was a martial arts expert that they proffered that mentioned that, in his view and in his experience, an elbow blow could fracture the sternum.
There was a problem in calling him, wasn't there? Wasn't he Mr. Kwok's martial art trainer?
No, it was a different martial arts instructor who was called at trial. The one who came in at the motion for new trial, I believe, was somebody different.
Had he had any experience with that, however?
I
thought he had not, was one of the problems.
Had any experience with?
Elbows breaking sternums, as opposed to imagining that it might.
I can't say for sure. I think he was opining that in his experience, I mean, I don't think he ever did it himself or saw that happen.
So you're going to have some martial arts guy come in who's never seen it happen, who's never done it himself, and he was going to be an expert to say it could happen.
Well,
in contradistinction to the medical expert.
The point would have been is get an expert, not necessarily a martial arts expert. I think the preferable expert to procure would have been a forensic expert on par with the experience of the medical examiner who could perhaps opine about that aspect.
Now, generally, when one is challenging the failure to procure an expert, there's a proffer made. I've now found an expert who is willing to say this. So what was the evidence in the record before the district court that there was a medical expert out there who would, in fact, proffer this opinion?
There was not any evidence on the record that a medical expert would proffer that opinion. What there was, as I alluded to, was there was evidence that this could happen. So the court is correct there.
Now, why not? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Edens. Do you want to reserve?
I will. Thank you, Judge.
Good morning. May I please the court? I'm Don Fudo. I'm representing what we've called the state in the briefs. Two decades ago in Strickland, the court admonished that courts should strive to ensure that ineffectiveness claims not become so burdensome to defense counsel that the entire criminal justice suffers as a result. I don't believe the case could have that profound an effect on the entire criminal justice system. But in as much as I live in a small community within which is an even smaller legal community, to countenance or give credit any kind of credibility to this particular claim on this record, I believe it would cause this system to suffer. As Justice Rawlinson pointed out with respect to the procuring of the expert, in a habeas claim, when you're challenging the ineffective assistance of counsel, it would be petitioner's burden to procure that person and give an affidavit or supply the testimony of that person from which a court could reasonably conclude either not procuring that expert was a specific error or omission, and or the second Strickland prong, which was not procuring was prejudicial. We don't have that in this case because counsel basically has done very little what Ninth Circuit jurisprudence says he must do. Counsel did not interview this, what he characterizes as exculpatory witness. He did exactly the same as trial counsel. He reviewed written documents, which evince only one thing, that exculpatory witness is not exculpatory. She was incredulous. She admitted she lied. She admitted she was biased for the victim because it was her friend. She wanted to see someone held accountable for his death. With respect to her account that it was an elbow that caused the injury, I've heard what I think gratuitously characterized as a summary of what the cause of death was, but what the medical examiner says, it wasn't just that a elbow strike couldn't fracture a sternum, But the circumstances of this case, it wasn't just a fractured sternum. Fractured sternum, fractured rib, bruised heart, bruised lung. On those circumstances, she said all it could have been to create that much force was a kick. There was not one other witness that would corroborate what counsel is saying was the exculpatory witness. Now, what counsel seems to be saying is the gist of his position is trial counsel had nothing to lose. The Supreme Court has already opined on the nothing to lose theory in Woods, in which they said, we have never, ever, in a Strickland-type claim, held that counsel is ineffective for not presenting each and every defense. In fact, it's consistently been the Supreme Court's jurisprudence that, dating back from Strickland, also in Yarborough, that a judicious and professional counsel, in order to maintain credibility with the fact finder, doesn't necessarily run a shotgun defense theory. They present viable theories based upon the facts and the evidence for which the fact finder then will also attribute credibility to counsel as well as the argument. To just throw things out as Miss Loy, that was trial counsel, was aware, it would damage her credibility. More so when no one else, professional expert, witness, lay witness, or otherwise, would support that theory.
Kai was a friend of the victim?
Kai was a friend of the victim, yes, Your Honor.
And you say that would cut against her credibility?
No. What cuts against her credibility is the fact that she admitted she lied. And the reason she lied was she wanted someone held accountable for the injury that was inflicted to her friend. So I think it's the lying, clearly, her own admission, that seems a cut against credibility, but equally so from a neutral source, which would be the medical examiner, that her recitation of how the person died
was
simply...
Did the counsel interview her?
Trial counsel?
Yes.
No, trial counsel read both of her statements to the police.
No, but isn't that a little odd? And when you have a witness who potentially could support precisely your theory, and that is that your client didn't do it. Now, maybe she has some credibility problems, but doesn't that strike you as somewhat odd that the counsel wouldn't actually interview a potentially key witness and make a determination eyeball to eyeball as to whether that witness would be able to support your claim?
Eyeball to eyeball would not affect what she said substantively in the first two statements.
Yeah, but there may be reasons why she said that. You have to talk to her and find out. Maybe she was under pressure. She wanted something to happen. Of course, she had her poor friend who died, etc. But it, I mean, there's only one witness in this case that apparently could change, you know, that would go totally at odds with what Mr. Torres said, and that's this Ms. Khan, and she's not interviewed.
And here again, counsel did not interview her.
No, I know, but we're talking about trial counsel.
And that's, I'm talking about the ineffectiveness assistance of counsel in the Ninth Circuit jurisprudence. When you say that you are ineffective for not having a particular witness, it's incumbent upon the petitioner to identify the witness, get what the witness's statement would have been, and explain how that putative testimony would have affected the outcome. Counsel hasn't supplied that information to the court. So I don't want to just speculate what it would have been, but what I can point the court to is what I will say would be the third interview. She testified at the post-trial hearing. She didn't say anything substantively different than she did in her first statement or her second statement. So in as much as petitioner has not given this court any information from which to conclude, well, in a fourth interview, looking her eye to eye as the post-trial judge did, I find her credible. The post-trial judge, he heard her, saw her eye to eye, as this court has pointed out, and found her incredulous. No one has ever said anything other than it's incredulous. The district court agreed with that finding. And the standard of review should be at this point that unless the petitioner shows the district court's finding was clearly erroneous, well, it should not be affected. There is no evidence that counsel has given this court that anything could have changed the result of that trial. It's all speculation and it's all conjecture. With Ninth Circuit and Supreme Court jurisprudence says is insufficient to support the prejudice prong as well as the specific error omission prong. He just would like this court to believe, without presenting any evidence, yes, had she run this nothing to lose theory, which Wood says isn't ineffective, who knows? Throw it on the wall, jury might have stuck with it. Why? Are we assuming the jury was acting capricious, that they wouldn't see the inconsistencies, that they would overlook those and disregard the medical examiner's testimony and all the other witnesses that didn't corroborate it and find yes? We still find her credible. That's exactly not the way we're supposed to make the assessment with respect to the prejudice prong that Strickland tells us clearly. We're to assume that the jury, the fact finder, is not arbitrary, is not capricious, and will dutifully fulfill their duties. Without evidence, to think that on this record, they would have just found, no, you're right, it was the elbow. There's just simply no basis to do that. There's simply no basis in the record for this court to find that the district court unreasonably reached its determination that Ms. Loy made strategic decisions which under Strickland do not constitute ineffective assistance of counsel.
Thank you. I think we have your argument in mind.
The point is with that witness is she says somebody else did it. And granted, there was testimony about there being limited investigative resources, but when you have all these witnesses, why not interview the one witness that can corroborate your defense theory that your guy didn't do it? And that's what happened in this case, or did not happen in this particular case. And what's interesting in this so-called shotgun approach is when the detective testified in this case, trial counsel then brought up Ms. Kai's testimony. Wasn't there a witness who said that somebody else did it? Wasn't there a witness who said that the fatal blow was caused in a different manner? She raised the issue specifically. So when we talk about, you know, we can't have the shotgun approach, that shotgun approach was brought up in this.
Well, that was actually pretty clever lawyering, actually. You don't get stuck with an incredulous witness, but you get the benefit of the testimony. So that suggests to me some sophisticated lawyering rather than lack of reasonable representation, doesn't it?
I would submit that you have the live witness who not only testified to that, but also testified that Mr. Torres was not there along with everybody else. And that's the additional prong.
Your opponent suggests that Kai, do I pronounce that correctly?
Yes.
Kai admitted that she lied. Is that true?
With respect to the kick versus the elbow, that is correct. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank both counsel for your argument this morning. Kwok versus Frank is submitted. And we'll next hear argument in Deguchi versus Allstate Insurance Company. Proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. And thank you for the opportunity to appear here this morning. My name is Eric Seitz. I represent the plaintiffs' appellants in this matter. Unlike virtually all of the cases cited and relied upon by Allstate, in this case, both the insureds and the insurance company acted irresponsibly. And neither party should benefit or enjoy a windfall or be unjustly enriched in a situation where both parties arguably were at fault. On advice of their counsel at that time, my clients failed to produce relevant and material documents and records and to complete their examinations under oath. That is true. On the other hand, Allstate refused to produce a copy of Ms. Deguchi's initial statement, caused Mr. Scalas to travel from the mainland to Hilo for a scheduled examination, which had been canceled because of Allstate's lawyer being on vacation, and demanded that the clients then be available for 2 days of examination each in Las Vegas, which would have necessitated an expense of somewhere between $20,000 to $30,000 for their attorney from Honolulu to fly and spend a total of 5 or 6 days in these examinations in a case that wasn't that complicated. All of that was exceptionally unreasonable on the part of Allstate. It was at that point that Mr. Ashford, who was counsel for the insureds, became very upset, and the process broke down, and he filed the lawsuit, the bad faith lawsuit, which he did. But again, I want to emphasize that this is a unique case where both parties contributed to that breakdown.
Well, even if that's true, and we just accept that, and you know, bad blood between insureds and insurance companies seems to be a way of life to some degree because they have opposing interests in coverage. But don't we get to the fundamental question as to whether your client can refuse to answer questions about financial, their financial situation, and that is essentially a breach of their agreement?
No, you don't need to get to that point because I'm conceding it.
And then why is that not all the further we need to get? Why don't you explain why you think we need to go further?
Precisely. We've cited to you several cases in which there have been breaches, some as significant as these, where the courts have not merely dismissed the claims and allowed the insurance company to avoid liability altogether, but where the court has issued an order saying that we will afford you an opportunity to go back and remedy what has transpired.
And I appreciate those cases. They give you a do-over proposition. But the question I have is, do you have any cases where a court of appeals actually reversed a district court for not providing that kind of opportunity?
Well, if you look at the Powell case that we cited, which is a Fourth Circuit case, it's unclear from that case what the ultimate remedy was, but the case was remanded for the district court to determine in that situation what should take place next and whether or not there should be further inquiry. That's the only one I can find. The others are all trial court determinations on motions as
is
far
it,
as...
Is it your argument that a district judge facing this kind of situation where the company apparently with justifiable reason asks for financial information and at least initially the insureds refuse, that when it gets to court they say we've changed our mind, we now want to give, we're willing to give that information up, that a trial judge in that situation is required to conditionally deny summary judgment to the insurance company?
It is my position that that is exactly what should take place if...
Your position is that should be mandatory.
If the insurance company contributed to the breakdown of the relationship. Otherwise, if it's a question of whether or not one party or another acted reasonably, then that is a, and we've cited you some cases, that's a fact issue which ought to be tried. But where you have a record where both parties have acted unreasonably and that unreasonableness has contributed to the breakdown, then yes, it is incumbent, I believe, on the court to allow the parties to go back and try to complete the process under guidance, under an appropriate order. You can grant the motion for summary judgment without prejudice and dismiss the case without prejudice, subject to conditions, and thereafter those conditions are not adhered to, you can grant it with prejudice.
Now, what's the language in Powell that you say supports your argument in this regard?
The language is essentially, it says we agree with the district
what
court.
Page are you on?
I'm on page 4. This is a Lexis decision now. Let me see if I can find, it's 274 of the court's opinion, I believe.
Okay, got it.
All right, so basically it says we agree with the district court that the Virginia courts would read the examination under oath language, broadly enough to encompass financial motivations for suspected fraudulent conduct. That is like this case, and we concur.
Right, but what in there says that the district, that the court should allow a do-over?
Oh, let me suggest, I'm sorry, I misspoke. What happened in that case was that there was simply a bad faith claim that was on appeal. And so what they basically did was affirmed the summary judgment on the bad faith claim. But there is, at least by implication in this case, and that's as close as I can get on an appellate court level, by implication, there were no claims and there was no summary judgment that denied the claim altogether. All there was in this case were bad faith claims. And I'm not objecting to summary judgment being granted with respect to our case as to the bad faith claims that were brought. I think that was appropriate.
So actually, there is no language in there that suggests that there should be a do-over opportunity.
Right. I'm interpreting that case to say that it only involved the bad faith claims. And what I'm suggesting is that the action that was taken there leaves open on appeal, when it was remanded, the possibility that the parties would be allowed to continue to pursue the process of the claim.
Because the district court cited Powell to support its finding that it was appropriate to have the examination under oath to investigate possible financial basis.
And I agree with that, and I agree. But again, you have a situation here where, first of all, the clients didn't just refuse to cooperate like some of the cases which the insurance company cites. This was a case in which they met. Ms. DiGucci was examined for 4 hours. Mr. Scalas flew there for his examination. But there were obvious failures to produce documents. And then there was this gross demand, which I think was vastly unreasonable, that they set aside 2 full days each to be examined under oath.
Yeah, but you know, that's kind of counsel back and forth. But the bottom line is that they didn't want to answer questions about their finances. And we have this boat that, at least somewhere in the documents, is suggested disappeared under suspicious circumstances, at least circumstances that can't be verified. And the insurance company kind of wants to know, well, why'd you buy the boat? What are your finances? What's your situation at the time? That's pretty basic information that they don't want to answer.
And I concede that that information is information to which they're entitled. I concede that.
I know, but so it's a very odd thing. So this is, they change attorneys. They ask them this information. Your clients refuse to provide it. And then your clients file suit against the insurance company.
Should not have been done. It should not have been done.
The problem is that the district court, when the district court, when he sees the case, that's what he sees. He sees your client suing the insurance company, but these are the same clients that won't answer the basic questions. So if I get your argument, which I think I can understand why you're making it, but you basically would like us to say that the district court somehow abused its discretion in not saying, okay, go back and now answer these questions.
Exactly. And again, the first prong of that
is there anything between October 2006 and now that prevented your clients from providing this information to the insurance company?
Well, again, this is outside the record, but we offered to do that.
I'm just asking if there was anything structurally that prevented it.
No, there wasn't. Okay. We offered to.
Well, I don't want to know outside
but
the
that's,
record.
Again,
I only want to know what's on the
sure.
record for the
And again,
court.
You're looking at a case here now where, for example, the insurance company says that there were financial issues because there was some question about whether these people could continue to pay for the boat. But then you have in the record information that shows that they did pay off the mortgage. You have information that says that Ms. DiGucci sold off assets. And they obviously had assets. They just didn't have a good income flow. There were certainly enough to raise suspicions on the part of the insurance company, and we concede that. But in a case where there were mere suspicions and no actual evidence of any fraud, to take the claim away altogether because there was this animosity that arose to which the insurance company committed or contributed is, in our view, inviting insurance companies to engage in this kind of conduct as much as it is encouraging individuals to hold back information which the insurance company is entitled to receive.
Are you the third lawyer on this case?
Yes. And I don't justify either party acting the way they did. The problem here is it of such a nature that Allstate gets a $200,000 windfall? And I don't think that's just. And that is really the essence of our case in a state which has not decided those issues, because the state of the law is the one Hawaii case which has been cited to you. And in our view, in Hawaii, we believe that there would be a more humane approach to this if this were decided by the state courts. And that is the essence of our position.
It is correct that when Scalise appeared at his examination under oath in October, he refused to answer questions like, when did you start looking for a boat? Why did you pick this boat to buy? Or what he did for a living. Is that correct?
By that point, there was such animosity that, yes, you are correct, that basically Mr. Ashford, who represented him, was a feisty lawyer, a very prominent member of this bar who's just only recently died. Mr. Ashford was obviously suspicious that the insurance company was doing things that they should not have been entitled to do. And that is why those decisions were made. We regret that. But the question is, what should the consequence be where there were equally, I believe, acts of misconduct by the insurance company? The consequences of that should not fall entirely.
Why don't we hear from the insurance company?
And let me say, just if I may, before I sit down, I have no problem paying the attorney's fees and costs that were occasioned by this bad faith lawsuit that should not have been filed.
Let me ask one last question. Just, I want a yes or no answer. Did this case go to mediation in the Ninth Circuit?
It did not.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kevin Sumita for the insurance company, Allstate, LE. Let me first say that I believe that the theory now propounded this morning is a brand new one that has not been really discussed in the briefs. There is no evidence whatsoever of some kind of animosity between the parties. This is as much a figment of imagination as the allegation made in the opening brief that the questioning of Deguchi was, quote, argumentative, snide, sarcastic, and insulting. There is no evidence of that. It was offered. We pointed out that the transcript in which counsel was representing Ms. Deguchi made no comment whatsoever. Ms. Deguchi made no comment whatsoever at the examination about any allegedly argumentative, snide, sarcastic, or insulting comments.
When was the first time that anyone representing the insureds told Allstate, we'll provide the financial information you want?
That's a tricky question, only in this respect. At the examination of Ms. Deguchi, she brought a bunch of documents which presumably included the financial information requested. We were not allowed to see it at the time. She promised to turn it over to the court reporter, and then the record shows that she did so do so on the record, and then she never produced them, even though multiple requests were made in writing to both her when she was not represented and to her attorneys.
I'm sure Mr. Seitz would say that that was under the influence of her evil prior lawyer.
I would disagree. First of all, as the court rightfully points out, there were three attorneys involved. The first attorney was a man named Mr. Nishimura, who is on the neighbor island, and he is not quite the feisty attorney that Mr. Ashford might be accused of being. He was asked to produce the information, and he never did, and then he bowed out, and then there was a time when the insureds were not represented by counsel. Prior to that, they were informed by two separate adjusters in the course of their investigation that you must cooperate under the policy. You must produce documents, you must submit for examination. And if you don't do that, you may jeopardize your policy benefits. They were told
What about by the time you got to district court? Is there anything in the record in district court where they agreed to provide this information?
No. The claim that there was animosity between the parties is completely unsupported by the record, and in fact there was no animosity. One of the prime elements which counsel now tries to create this claim of animosity was the request by Allstate that the examination be conducted in Las Vegas. The reason for that was because Allstate discovered that the plaintiffs had moved to Las Vegas, and so Allstate was willing to submit to send its counsel up there at its own expense and at the convenience of the plaintiffs to complete the examination there. And then given the fact that of what occurred in the first examination of Ms. Deguchi, and if you read the transcript, you can see that Ms. Deguchi was not constrained to answer only the question presented. She would go on and on and on. So it was clear that the examination might take a little longer. That was for her. And then for Mr. Scalise, There was indication that Mr. Scalise did not speak English as a primary language, and so there was an anticipation that he might transit would be required, and so that would again lengthen the course of the examination. The bottom line is that the law is very clear in Hawaii. It's not at all unclear that the insureds must submit to examination, and if they fail to do so, that their claim must be denied. The examination process is an important process for the purpose of insurance companies investigating and validating a loss. And in this case, there was complete failure to cooperate, despite reputed requests to do so. And I would urge the court to carefully review the well-reasoned and thorough decision of the district court, who I think looked at everything very carefully. So
is the answer to the question I first asked you today?
I'm sorry.
The question was, when was the first time that the insureds told Allstate they would produce the financial information it wanted to examine?
You know, I believe I would make the same point that Mr. Seitz made. I think there might have been a discussion after the court entered summary judgment about a do-over, but that would be about the best of it. I don't believe anything's in the record regarding that issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Just briefly on several points. First of all, I don't regard Mr. Ashford as the evil attorney. He was a dear friend and somebody we deeply respected, but he was very angry. And I think you can read that from the pleadings and the manner in which this case was handled, especially about him having to travel to Las Vegas at a cost that was enormous for 2 days of examinations for each party.
Is it correct that's where the insureds were?
That's where they were, and we don't complain about them scheduling them in Las Vegas. What we complain about is that they wanted 2 days each, which would have incurred an expense, $20,000 to $30,000 of expense in fees.
Was it true that there may have been a need for a translator?
No, there wasn't any need for a translator. The man speaks excellent English. Okay. So that's the first thing. The second thing I want to say is that although the law in Hawaii is clear that, yes, these documents should have been provided, the scope of the exam and the reasonableness of a refusal to participate at any stage is not clear. All you have is the Barabin case. You don't have any other law in Hawaii that clarifies
that. But if it's not clear, then don't you lose? If the district court exercised discretion in an area that's not clear, why don't you lose?
Because if the question was reasonableness and there were contentions as to why things happened and what precipitated certain actions, those are fact issues that should have been tried. Whether each party or both parties acted reasonably or unreasonably were fact issues and not subject to summary judgment in a situation where, as I am asserting, that both parties contributed to the breakdown. And lastly, let me say that it's not clear that these parties were unwilling to provide the financial information. Some of it was provided, and you see it in the record. But the fact is that they were about to provide it on a couple of occasions, and other events ensued. And
is any of that in the record?
Yes.
What do you point to?
Well, first of all, you have Mr. Scalise's scheduled examination that was supposed to take place in Hilo, for which he flew and came. And he had, as I understand it, was prepared to answer all the questions, but Allstate's lawyer was on vacation. And then you have the discussion of continuing those examinations in Las Vegas. And had they been handled more reasonably and said, we'll set aside a half a day or a day as opposed to 2 days each, which is 2 to 3 times what we allow in depositions in federal court, I think that there would have been a resolution of all of those questions, because it certainly is clear that the documentation Allstate wanted was something they were entitled to and it was available. But how they would get it at that point when they were making the kinds of demands that they were making contributed to a breakdown. And I don't believe our clients should suffer the loss of their claim under those circumstances where they did cooperate to some degree, albeit not to the degree required by law.
Thank you. Thank you both counsel for your argument this morning. DiGucci versus Allstate Insurance Company is submitted. The next argument this morning is Craig Elmer Chapman versus Journal Concepts, Inc. Mm-hmm.
morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. I am Arnold Phillips, representing Craig Chapman, the appellant. And, Your Honors, this case poses hazards to individual liberty of dramatic proportions. The issue is, to what extent is the privilege and the exception to the rule providing relief to an individual citizen for defamation to be extended? If we follow this case, we have actually extinguished the privilege and the exception has become the rule. That follows from the court's determination granting to Mr. Chapman the general purpose public figure status. The court went through its analysis. We have reviewed and criticized our analysis of that. It's very interesting because in the 40s and 50s and 60s before Times v. Sullivan, this article would have been considered, in my opinion, a hatchet job. If we were here discussing pornography, this piece would have no redeeming social value. It is not for the purpose of any public issue, Your Honor. It is only for the purpose of disparaging Mr. Chapman.
Well, let me ask you about that. I think as you point out, this question of your client as a public figure is a very interesting and difficult legal question.
Very interesting, very difficult. Yes, Your Honor.
But it seemed to me that in the end, that neither the judge nor the jury actually had to get to that question, because if the statements were true and there wasn't any actual defamation, then you wouldn't need to determine the intent with which they were made. So I'm wondering if you might focus on that, because we have two statements that went to the jury, that and then the judge also had knocked out some in advance. So it'd be helpful to me, because I think in some ways the case rises and falls first on that issue, and then you have to get to the next issue.
Very good. The landscape of the litigation was changed by the decision that the judge made granting the privileged status to Mr. Chapman, because it changed the standard from negligence to actual malice. It also took out defendants and causes of action. Had we been proceeding with those defendants and those causes of action, we would have been able to put more evidence in front of the jury of the actions of the publisher.
Let me just be specific.
Okay.
I'm looking at the verdict form, and they talk about the first question.
The first question is falsity, Your Honor. Correct.
Yeah, the first question is falsity about Jeff Johnson's quotation about your client. How would that have changed?
Your Honor, it wouldn't have changed. It wouldn't have changed.
Okay.
It would have probably been the same question.
But how would the evidence, I guess Judge Rollins and I are kind of responding to your statement that you would have had maybe different defendants and different evidence.
Well, for instance, we would have had in the photographer would have stayed in the case. The photographer came and took pictures of Mr. Chapman's surfing, his shaping room, saying that he was just doing it because he was casually interested in it. He was doing it under directions of the publisher to go out and get some pictures of this room. All right, so we would have had possibly a misappropriation, maybe other torts there. That information would have been in front of the jury. We would have been able to get into some of the investigation and lack of investigation, some of the violations of some of the journalistic practice standards. We would have had more ability to get.
Wouldn't you definitely have to do that anyway if you're going to go down the malice route? I mean, why would that change?
Well, it changed because they were no longer defendants and the causes of action were no longer there because of the judge's ruling on that. So,
The photographer is one person.
Right, the photographer is one person and the photographs. Mm-hmm. And the editor gave directions about the scurrilous and profane. Go out and see if you can get some scurrilous and profane takes on this guy, that sort of thing. It also involved...
You couldn't introduce that evidence?
Your Honor, I believe that evidence, it got in, but the part of that email that didn't get in was the reference to the Burroughs.
Okay, so that's a separate thing, because Burroughs kind of is over here with the judge.
Well, it's a separate thing.
The judge made a decision on Burroughs, correct?
The judge did make a decision on Burroughs.
Okay. So why don't we just start with that? Is you disagree with that decision?
I disagree with that decision, Your Honor. And the reason I disagree with you, can't read the article. You can, from the title of the article to the last paragraph of the article, a reasonable person could not understand that article without having an information about who El Hombre is, invisible, and the references to Old Bull Lee and these other references that are made throughout the article. In other words, that would have provided the opportunity for us to get into the comparisons which the author has admitted he intended to draw between Mr. Chapman and Burroughs, and that would have gotten into all of this pedophilia and all of this drug involvement and escaping the country and all. The comparisons would have provided a better picture. The comparisons the author drew between the Burroughs article and Mr. Chapman would have provided for the jury a better context under Underwriter and the entire context to view what this publication was about. If you take out that from the start, you don't quite understand what this is about. Now, the court said, well, this is about a board transaction, and the plaintiff says that he was never in town during this period of time, which the author says this whole transaction took place. You know, the article...
Well, you were able to present that evidence, correct?
We were.
Look, this is false because you're saying that this whole board transaction or non-transaction took place, but I'm telling you my client wasn't even around to have it happen.
Well,
so I'm not sure how the judge's malice decision, as I'm trying to figure out how that possibly infected your ability to put on that testimony.
Okay, I'm not quite sure I follow you.
Well, I mean, maybe that's because I'm not following you. You're telling me that this decision on Burroughs and this decision on malice somehow changed your whole trial. I'm trying to figure out, well, what does that mean?
What that means, Your Honor, is that we are limited from presenting the picture of the article in its context, the entire article, and all the disparaging innuendos which it makes about Mr. Chapman, beginning with the first situation where he's lurking, he's compared to picking up this kid in the parking lot. Now, where would that come from, and how would that make any difference without being able to place that in connection with the title and talk about Mr. Burroughs' conduct in his life? So when we were taken away from us. For instance, I'll give you another example. When we had this issue come up about the drugs. Now, the drugs issue, the comment was sober, which I think the general understanding of sober is, you know, it has to do with alcohol and alcohol abuse. The Thursday before the trial, at a motion in limine, the defendants left the courtroom, called Mr. Pesman, and Mr. Pesman said he meant heroin. All right? So, up until that point, if any of the drug information would also have been information which was raised by the defendants in their references to Mr. Burroughs and his heroin addiction and his heroin conduct, heroin-related conduct. So we didn't have that. We didn't have the comparison with Burroughs. We weren't able to get into the mindset of the publisher. There was one instance, Your Honor, where we had another, it's the Hackman situation, where it's another article by Mr. Pesman about another surfer that involves heroin, and I wanted to question Mr. Pesman about how he handled that so differently. In that case, he sat down with Mr. Hackman and his representatives, and they discussed how they were going to do it, and the editor of the book he was writing, and everybody was involved. And they handled it in a very sensible, reasonable way, as opposed to what happened in this case, where we have this comment that comes out in the liner notes that just sort of drops in there like a bomb. And so, but I didn't have that. So what was there that I had to show actual malice, to show the mindset of the publisher, to show that it's to establish the actual malice? I mean, I lost that opportunity. I couldn't get into and had to respond to the heroin statements that Mr. Pesman made. I mean, it was, I actually think, Your Honor, I think about it a lot, and I think that because in the opening statement, we said that we were going to bring in the almost statement. We were going to bring in the tape, the fact that this tape couldn't possibly, according, unless Mr. Baxter was incorrect in calculating the age of his son, was not made until after the article, which would establish, you know, certain help us in the malice. And so, I lost my point there. Without any of those, the jury was just exhausted. I think that's the only reason in my mind that I think they answered this question. They had seen so much taken away from the plaintiff during the trial that even though they'd heard Mr. Pesman testify that he made the statement, it was false, he said it, Mr. Baxter didn't say it, that they just said, you know, they were, I think they felt directed in a sense, not consciously, but unconsciously, by the way this had proceeded, to make that determination about the falsity of the statement. Because it's clear from the record, Your Honor, it's clear from Mr. Pesman's own testimony, that statement was a fabricated statement that he made up, and those words he placed in Mr. Fletcher's mouth as if Mr. Fletcher made the statement. So
do you want to save your 2 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Okay. Good morning. May it please the court. Elijah Yip, along with Jeffrey Portnoy, for the appellees. Like many defamation cases, this is a case that originates with bruised egos. And in the surfing world, egos are not common. Surfing personalities have a colorful history, and sometimes their egos lead to scuffles. And usually those scuffles get resolved on the beach, but in this case, it's gone into the courtroom, and not just that, but to the point of a 7-day jury trial. But at the core, this case is about Mr. Chapman trying to protect his legend and his ego. And Mr. Chapman believes that for whatever reason that a good-natured, good-humored article about him actually attacks him. And because he feels that threat, he's made some outrageous
allegations. Well, it's not all that good-humored when you accuse somebody of drug use and cutting in and surfing and not delivering the boards on time. I wouldn't call that like a puff piece, would you?
Your Honor, that's a point well taken. But that has to be taken in the context of the surfing community. Attributes which other communities might view as perhaps not favorable in the surfing community adds character to the persona, in this case the persona of Mr. Chapman. So these characteristics in the article were not meant to demean him, but rather to add to the flavor that was there already. And
but
to
what,
convey,
what about this, the one statement that went to the jury, I heard he's been sober for the last year.
Yes.
The person being interviewed didn't make that statement, right? The interviewer made it?
He did not actually make the state that particular statement, but the gist of that statement he agreed with. What that passage represented was an exchange between the interviewer, Steve Pesman.
Who made that statement.
Who made that statement.
And then he says, 1 year out of 40.
Correct. Correct. And again, the context of that statement, again, was not to say, well, here's a bad person. He's been on drugs for 40 years. It was actually it was a complimentary one. It was more along the lines of, well, he's finally sober. That's a good thing.
If it was a compliment, it certainly was a backhanded compliment.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I would agree with that. I would agree with that, definitely. Your Honor, I would like to address a couple of the points raised during the appellant's argument, if the court would indulge me. I completely agree with Judge McEwen's analytical framework regarding the public figure status. I think before we even get to that issue, we have to consider that the jury didn't have to consider the public figure status. The jury determined that the statements, disputed statements, were not false. That knocks out an element of the prima facie case.
What do you do, though, with opposing counsel's representation that the evidence would have come in differently but for the district court's preliminary ruling that Mr. Chapman was a public figure?
I disagree with that for a number of reasons. First of all, in regards to the element of fault, and with the court's ruling it would be actual malice, that actually raises the bar. And so the evidence that he would have had to present would have met a negligence standard. It should, because it's a higher bar, not a lower one. So he has, the Chapman has no excuse to say, well, I've been prevented from presenting evidence that would disallow me from proving my case. It's a higher standard. He had to meet it. If he wanted to meet it, he would have to present that kind of evidence. Moreover, again, the analytical framework here is important. He had to present evidence of falsity, and he tried doing that. The jury got the issue and determined that the statements were not false. That's an element that's distinct from the fault element. And so, regardless of what kind of evidence he introduced about fault, the dispositive issue here is falsity. That's the jury verdict, that these statements were not false, the end of the story. We don't even get to fault. We don't need to. And that's very important because, Your Honor, I also want to point out that his claim, Mr. Chapman's counsel, represents to this court that because of the public figure ruling, certain cause of action and defendants were knocked out. I disagree with that. That's not the effect of the ruling. All the ruling did was impose a higher level of fault as to those defendants, and with regard to the cause of actions, they were dismissed on other grounds which were not on appeal before the court here.
Would you address his comments about the Burroughs illusion? And as I understand it, he's saying, if you don't put in this evidence about what the Burroughs illusion means, then you're not putting the article in context, and that, you know, this sort of wild and crazy drug crazed person of Mr. Burroughs and the world he lived in, literary and otherwise,
sure,
that you need that for context, otherwise it disadvantages his client, and that the district court shouldn't have excised that from the case.
And the answer to that question is that counsel was not precluded from mentioning Burroughs or going into some of the references at trial. He was not. In fact, counsel did ask the author, Jeff Johnson, questions about the Burroughs references. The court's ruling, in limine ruling, was not that all references to Burroughs per se are excluded. What he excluded were the literary works themselves. I mean, Mr. Chapman's counsel wanted to introduce the entire body of literature authored by Mr. Burroughs and make that part of the trial. That would have been a circus, Your Honor. The district court was acting completely within its discretion to exclude that type of evidence. But if I'll point the court to a couple of points in the record where Mr. Johnson was asked to explain references like El Hombre Invisible or Naked Lunch or some of the titles referenced in the article. Excerpts of Record, Volume 1 at 61, that's an exchange where counsel for Mr. Chapman asked Mr. Johnson, what do these references mean? So there was an opportunity to generally ask about these references, and by doing that, for the jury to get a flavor of the context. But what counsel wanted to do was to take the extra step now of importing all these references, all these allusions, all these literary works from written by Mr. Burroughs, and make that part of the trial. And that the trial could have gone on for days if that happened. And so that was completely an appropriate act of discretion by the district court to exclude that evidence. There's also a similar correct exercise of discretion as to the drugs issue. Now, Mr. Phillips makes a reference to an article about Hackman, and this was an article that Mr. Pesman had authored in years past. The reason that article was excluded was because it was a completely new exhibit offered on the third day of trial, I believe. We had not given any notice previous to that counsel would use that article, and so again the court rightfully excluded that article. I would note though that there were references at trial to the heroin use. It was not as if counsel was precluded from going into the drug references. So there was evidence of that, and again, based on the evidence presented, the jury decided the statements were substantially true. And so, Your Honor, if we look at the analytical framework here, the jury ruled on the one dispositive issue, falsity, and it determined that the statements were not false, did not need to get to the public figure, the false issue, and that disposed of the case. I just want to touch briefly on the post-trial motions, because I think that procedurally they're also barred. With respect to the Rule 50B motion, a renewed motion for judgment as a matter of law, there was no Rule 50A motion. There was no motion for judgment as a matter of law made by Mr. Chapman before submission of the case to the jury. So obviously there cannot be a renewed motion. So that's barred. And finally, as with respect to the new trial, the standard there is exceptionally high. The evidence has to be against the great weight of the jury verdict. And I think the record is very clear that there was evidence to support the jury's verdict. And so there were no grounds for a new trial being granted to Mr. Chapman. And unless the court has any further questions, we urge an affirmance. Thank you.
Thank you. You have some rebuttal time.
Your Honor, just let me respond to a couple of the points made there. We have the background, and it's in the liner notes, and it starts with Mr. Pesman and Mr. Chapman's relationship when he was 16 years old in Huntington Beach, California, and he was the younger brother of a Gary Chapman, who was another, and they mixed it up. They were not good friends. I guess Mr. Pesman's name was Honey Bear, and he ran a sheriff shop, and they named Mr. Chapman after his eyeglasses. For some reason, this animosity has continued. If you take all of the articles that the defendants have submitted that mention Mr. Chapman, there's only one article that is not either by Pesman or by an organization that he was operating, either by his own company. So I don't know what it was, but this, and that went on until the late 1989, and then there was this quiet period. And I think it's very important that the court look at the Finnegan article, which was in the New Yorker magazine, which the defendants point to as showing that Mr. Chapman is a public figure because he obviously has access to the media, because he just got into the New Yorker magazine in 2006. Actually, that's a very interesting article because it's not an article about surfing culture per se. It's an article about the demise of a company that supplied the material that they made the surfboards out of. And it says that Mr. Chapman at that time was, the last time I saw Chapman was in 1997 in a ramshackle shed in the jungle on the north shore of Oahu. He was pretty much living board to board. It doesn't sound like a public figure to me. The privilege and the exception that the publisher has provided is if there's something that he's publishing that has a public interest to it. And there is nothing in this article that's a public interest. And I thank you for the court's time.
Thank you. Thank both counsel for this argument this morning. The case of Chapman versus Journal Concepts is submitted. We'll take a 5-minute break, and counsel for United States versus Acuna, Valenzuela, Oldwin, and Ogata can get yourselves arranged.
All right.
Thank you. Good morning. So would someone like to explain to us how you will divide this up so that the judges and the clerk can understand the organization?
Thank you, Your Honor. With your Cheryl Gordon McLeod on behalf of Mr. Olguin. With your permission, I was going to begin for Mr. Olguin with about 10 minutes. Mr. Tipon would follow for Mr. Acuna with 5 minutes. Ms. McMillan would follow for Ms. Valenzuela with approximately 10 minutes. And Ms. Tamashiro would conclude for Ms. Ogata with 5 minutes. And I have been given permission to go a moment or two over my time if necessary, and Ms. McMillan has agreed to accommodate me.
All right.
If that's acceptable to the court.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Cheryl Gordon McLeod on behalf of Eddie Olguin. I wanted to begin by focusing on the sentencing issue in this case that I began with in the briefs. And the question there is whether the 2D1.1B1 gun enhancement can be applied to a defendant where the evidence showed that one gun was found November 28, 2007, when the conspiracy ended in 2005, and the other gun was supposedly sighted in 2003, whereas the trial evidence and the government's argued established that Mr. Olguin didn't begin to join the conspiracy until 2004, the year after. So with regard to the 2007 gun, this is when there was a search of Mr. Olguin's place, and it was found November 28th, the end of 2007. It was found in a dresser in his room. The conspiracy indisputably ended in 2005. That's how it was charged, and that's how it was argued. This court has been clear that the possession, in order to establish a 2D1.1B1 enhancement, the government must show that the gun was possessed during the criminal conduct and that it had some kind of a nexus to the criminal conduct.
Counsel, before we proceed further, may I ask you what is our standard of review in deciding this issue?
Yes, you may, Your Honor. Calling your attention to United States versus Abucci, that's a plain error case. If this court decides that the objection that was raised at sentencing, specifically the objection that there's no evidence in the trial record to support this, is insufficient to support the argument that I'm making, then you're left with plain error review. And under United States versus Abucci, A-B-B-O-U-C-H-I, that's this court's case from 2007, that court held that the plain error standard was satisfied when a sentencing adjustment was applied and there was no support for it in the record, or there was confusion in the record about whether there was support for it. That was a case, I think it was a child pornography case, but the sentence adjustment that was at issue there was a domestic violence treatment program for a number of years after sentencing. And this court held that there was not sufficient evidence in the record to support a 10-year domestic violence treatment program, and so it remanded on an open record to the district court.
So if we So if we accept that plain error standard of review applies, and under that standard of review, the enhancement should be upheld unless there is no support for it in the record. And then if we look at the PSR, there was a statement in the PSR that was attributable to Tavares that Olguin did, that Mr. Olguin possessed a firearm during a drug transaction in 2003. Does that defeat your argument?
No, Your Honor, and I think you've asked me three questions there. Let me try to take them all. I will answer you on the plain error standard. I do want to point out, though, that there was that objection at sentencing, and under this court's decision in United States versus Matthews, if there's an objection to the adjustment, there it was an armed career criminal adjustment, and it was made on the wrong grounds. It was made on the grounds of the facts rather than the prior elements meeting the Taylor test. The court said it still sufficed to preserve the objection because the court was on notice that the adjustment shouldn't have been applied. So I started with plain error because you get to hear the issue anyway, even under plain error standard, but I'm not conceding that that's the only basis for your review. If it is plain error standard, It's not a question of, is there any evidence anywhere in the record? It's, was there an error? Was it plain? Did it affect substantial rights?
I was just going based on your representation of what Abucci said. You said that in Abucci,
okay,
the plain error standard
lack of support in the record.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me talk about
the claimed error is with respect to the Mr. Barris and the 2003 okay. being within or without the conspiracy.
Okay. The statement in the PSR in paragraph 32 is that Tavares, a co-conspirator, saw a gun on Olguin at some point in 2003. It's no more specific
during
than that.
During a drug transaction.
During a during bringing the money back to Nevada, I think it was during the money part of the transaction.
And that
correct?
Was not objected to.
The plus two was objected to. It was objected to on the ground that there
did someone say to Judge Mulway that is inaccurate?
Paragraph 32. The contents of paragraph 32 are inaccurate.
No. Someone said to Judge Mulway, there's insufficient evidence to support the plus two, referring to the trial testimony. So if that's insufficient, we're on plain error review with this.
But if somebody stood up and said, Judge, that's just not true, the government could have brought this witness forward to say whether it was or wasn't. Right?
Well, I think the government would have had a problem doing that. And by the way, that's the same thing that happened in Abucci, and Abucci got reversed anyway. But I think the government would have had a problem bringing in Tavares to set it, because it wasn't only that there was testimony throughout the trial that Olguin didn't begin in the conspiracy until 2004. It's also that that's exactly what the government argued, and the government had to argue that because there was this Olguin bankruptcy in 2003, and the government, in response to that, had to argue, well, he didn't join the conspiracy until 2004. So,
if the government says it's not until 2004, and that's the argument made, you're sort of saying, well, this is kind of water under the bridge because it doesn't really matter since it's a 2003 date.
Well, I'm saying they're judicially stopped from bringing in a witness now to say, well, it was really 2004 because we want to support the...
You mean 2003?
Well, the gun was really seen in 2004 because we really want to support the...
But she could have clarified the date. That the problem with it is that the district court didn't have the opportunity to clarify anything because no objection was made to paragraph 32. There could have been, she could have been mistaken about the date. It could have really been 2004 instead of 2003, but we don't know because the district court judge was not required to make any findings about it because nobody objected. So if the district court had been put on notice, the district court could have clarified everything, and that's why it's so important to make objections to factual statements that are in the PSR.
Absolutely, and it's a problem to be stuck with plain error standard of review. However, the government was limited in what it could have clarified. It couldn't have brought Olguin's participation in the conspiracy back a year because it had already argued that he wasn't in the conspiracy
in 2003.
But Tavares could
have said, oh, I was mistaken. It wasn't 2003.
Should this be remanded?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So you're not asking us to make that determination?
I don't think I can ask you to do that.
You're basically saying that we've got this collision in the record, remand as to whether this was an appropriate enhancement.
And correct. And that's exactly what the court did in Abucci, where there was also no objection to that domestic violence thing, and the court said, what are we going to do here? And the big issue there was whether you remand on an open record or a closed record, and the court said, open record, if the government has the evidence, they can bring it in at the resentencing. So you're correct, Your Honor. All I'm asking for is a resentencing where if the government feels that it can correct this error, it would have an opportunity to do so.
Okay.
And simply in terms of the prejudice, you know, I'm going to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
All right, you have a minute and a half.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So now Mr. Kuna, which is Mr. Tippin, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Before we start, could it be possible to move the television monitor? I noticed that some of the counsel at defense table are having trouble seeing the panel.
Thank you.
So here, we'll set the time at 5 minutes, please. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Emmanuel Dupont. I represent the appellant Benjamin Acuna in this case. I will limit my argument to two issues, the sufficiency of the evidence and the constructive amendment variance issue. My co-counsel will address, Ms. McMillan will address the remaining issues, and I submit on those issues as our issues in our brief tend to overlap. With that in mind, in 2000, when the government and the indictment alleged that this conspiracy to distribute methamphetamine in Hawaii began, my client was 21 years old, and he was an immigrant with limited education, born in Durango, Mexico. One of the other alleged co-conspirators, Ms. Annabel Valenzuela, is a 17-year-old high school girl in Las Vegas. Now, the government's argument that these two were, and in the indictment, it is mentioned that the Ms. Annabel Valenzuela and Mr. Benjamin Acuna are the leaders, masterminds, if you will, organizers, and recruiters for this organization that began in 2000. And for the government's theory to survive, you'd have to believe that these two individuals, a 17-year-old girl, high school student, and a 21-year-old from Durango, Mexico, were these criminal masterminds who recruited and masterminded and organized a conspiracy that included over 18 co-conspirators and distributors between Nevada and Hawaii.
It doesn't matter, does it, counsel, what we might believe or what the world might believe. The question is whether there was sufficient evidence for the jury to find what they did, and whether the evidence, as I understand your argument, established a conspiracy different than the one charged in the indictment.
Yes, Your Honor. And part of the reason why I lay that forward is so that the court understands the background and the backdrop by which the jury has to examine the evidence. And the question that the court has to answer is whether any rational or reasonable trier of fact can believe beyond a reasonable doubt that the charged conspiracy was in fact what the evidence showed. And I think that this case falls squarely with the case of United States versus Martin, where I think that it's clear that the evidence is clear that the ringleaders and the organizers and the hub of this conspiracy are Rainey and Bulacan. Those are the ones who hatched this idea in 2003 to traffic methamphetamine in Hawaii. Because if the government,
but your client in Valenzuela are consistently identified as the meth sources, correct?
Unfortunately, they're only consistently identified by Rainey and Bulacan.
Do you need somebody else? I mean, in other words, that's the evidence. Maybe you don't like the evidence, but I'm having some trouble why, you know, they're consistently identified. Maybe he's lying, I don't know. But that's the evidence. So
yeah, sure.
Why isn't that sufficient? What are we supposed to make of that?
Well, the problem with those with their testimony is that, you know, ultimately, while it's a little bit outside this issue, those two are very interested witnesses. They were arrested. They
right.
were the ones who were arrested first.
But what's the standard of review here?
With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence?
Yeah.
Plain error. But I think that this case falls squarely with United States versus Martin in that. The facts are very similar. The government believed in United States versus Martin that Martin was the main guy in charging the conspiracy, and that he was in control of the entire thing, and that from him these conspiracies with Jackson and the other individuals sprung out. In the same instance here, the government believes in the indictment, and throughout their case, their theory is that it's Acuna and Valenzuela that are the hub, and it springs out. But in reality, I think the testimony and the evidence show that Rainey and Bulacan try very hard to exclude these two individuals from their conspiracy. And all they are is they supplied them with, they at best, they supplied them with methamphetamine. And what they did with it from that point was beyond their control and their belief with regard to this conspiracy. The conspiracy started with and ends with Rainey and Bulacan, because, you know, as the evidence shows, they were trafficking methamphetamine since 1996 or 1998, and then in 2003 they hatched this grand scheme to go bigger and better. And once Rainey was arrested in 2005, the conspiracy ended. That was it. And so it's obvious that those are the two people who are mainly involved. And I think Martin is the case that we should use as the analytical framework to determine where we can go from or how to analyze the case that we have at hand, because the facts are so similar. They okay. just have...
You're beyond your time already.
Oh, yes, Your
Honor. You noticed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Mr. Enciang. My name is Georgia McMillan. I represent the defendant appellant, Annabel Valenzuela. If it's okay with the court, I'm going to submit on the first two issues that Mr. Tapan spoke on concerning the overall conspiracy versus multiple conspiracy and the constructive amendment argument. And I would like to move into two other arguments made in the opening brief concerning misconduct and the use of the expert to price methamphetamine, Terry Chu. I have approximately 10 minutes, and I'll reserve a couple for rebuttal. Your Honor, Your Honors, we argue in the opening brief misconduct. This is a plain error issue, and we do not approach it lightly. We do not argue misconduct lightly. But we believe that the record shows cumulatively numerous instances of misconduct that warrant reversal. The misconduct comes in two main ways. One has to do with improper vouching, and the other has to do with improper cross-examination. With respect to the improper vouching, we see misconduct in raising the issue of truthfulness with respect to plea agreements, particularly with respect to Charles Rainey's plea agreement with the government. As well, we see issues of credibility of the co-conspirators raised with respect to closing statements. We acknowledge that the government is entitled to raise issues of credibility, provided those issues of credibility are based on the record. And this is our problem with the bulk of the closing statements. These statements concerning credibility, we do not think are supported by the record. And I'd like to go over some of those. The government says that the co-conspirators were reliable witnesses. In particular, it says that Bulacan and Rainey were reliable witnesses in their closing statement. Our interpretation of the record is that nothing could be further from the truth. Sherry Bulacan and Charles Rainey were completely unreliable. Indeed, in her testimony, Sherry Bulacan said, "You're just asking me about dates and amounts. I'm making them up. I'm just giving you dates and amounts." She said, with respect to dates and amounts, quote, "I'm not sure," end quote. Quote, "I'm just giving dates. You're asking me to give you one, so I'm giving you one," end quote. "I don't know the dates. I don't know the amounts. If I had to choose, I'm going with 5 years once a month." And this is referring to supposed drug deliveries from Benny Acuna, the husband of my client. Otherwise, with respect to the reliability or unreliability of these two witnesses, we couldn't even pin them down to when they said they met their supposed primary source, Benny Acuna. Sherry Bulacan says, "Oh, it was sometime in 2000 or 2001. Charles Rainey said that he met Acuna sometime in 2001 or 2002. We've got a big problem with those dates, as Mr. Tapan pointed out, because in 2002, Benny Acuna was arrested in May 2002. He was incarcerated until January 2003, and then he was deported. He didn't return to the country until October 2003 because his wife was pregnant. So we have to ask ourselves, how is he going to put together this huge, grand conspiracy when he's deported to Mexico?
Counsel, wasn't all of this evidence presented to the jury, and the argument was made to the jury? So if all of this was presented to the jury and the jury nevertheless convicted, on what basis can we say there was insufficient evidence? Because all of the inferences are to be drawn in support of the verdict.
We simply don't think it's sufficient, Your Honor. We just think that there's so many credibility problems. And when we take that sufficiency of the evidence argument and couple it with the misconduct and the problems we see, particularly with the closing statements and credibility calls on the part of the government that are not supported by the record, we think that it inures in our favor. And I would like to continue on with those credibility calls that were in the closing statements, if I may, unless there's other comments from the court.
Well, you have 5 minutes left. And
okay.
I'll just tell you personally, I would be more interested in hearing your argument about this pricing and the summary. Is that the other thing you were going to address?
Yes, it is, and I'll go there now, Your Honor.
You know, the other one is a record comparison. This is, presents an interesting legal issue.
Very well, Your Honor. So with respect to the expert, Terry Chu, we have a forfeiture count in the indictment, count two. And the forfeiture count calls for an $8 million forfeiture. The only support for that $8 million forfeiture award comes from the government's putting forward a veteran FBI agent, Terrence Chu, and a chart of unknown authorship, and I just happen to have it here. This is in volume 4 of our record. It's on page 83. And this expert testified concerning drug pricing in this case. And during the course of this, his testimony, it became very clear that notwithstanding this expert's experience in drug investigations, and this was acknowledged in the record, it became clear that Mr. Chu, the expert, was basically simply testifying off of this chart. There was an objection, and the court overruled the objection.
Yeah, we understand the background. So the question I have, it poses this interesting question of the intersection between our evidence rule that permits you to have summaries and the confrontation
Yes.
clause requirements that the Supreme Court has made more definitive in recent years. So under your theory, would that mean you could never really have a summary chart if the witness himself or herself wasn't the source of the chart?
Well, I can't speak to never ever, Your Honor, but in this particular case where, excuse me, this chart is the basis for this $8 million award, and we have an expert that does not know who authored it. Indeed, the author of this chart never came forward. We were never permitted the opportunity to cross-examine whoever put this chart together, and the chart itself represents some profound problems that we point out in the opening brief. For example, if you look at the chart on page 83, there's these clusters of bars, right? And there's a set of clusters of bars for 2007, but that section, an entire third of this chart, should be irrelevant because the count one conspiracy ended in September 2005. So we don't understand why you've got these clusters of bars representing 2007.
But counsel, Agent Chu was cross-examined about the information, and he said yes. The prices were consistent with his experience.
Yes.
So he was there to be cross-examined regarding the prices and what his experience reflected. So what is the objection in terms of the evidence that was presented, if it were presented as being consistent with his experience?
Agent Chu did say it's consistent with his experience. However, if we examine the record further, he had no experience with Mexico drug prices. Indeed, they asked him, well, where do the Mexico drug prices come from? And he speculated a DEA attaché in Mexico. I'm not even sure what a DEA attaché is anyway, but that's what he speculated to.
Those are the people attached to the embassy from the DEA usually.
Okay, well, at any rate, he testified that he had no experience with Mexico prices. He had no experience investigating this particular case, and that makes his reliance on this chart and his testimony, which is used as the basis for this $8 million award, highly problematic.
So that goes to the jury. Anytime you have an expert, you put the expert up there, the expert testifies as to what his opinion is, and then it's given more or less weight depending on how credible the trier of fact thinks that the expert is. So with the evidence having gone to the jury and both parties being able to argue the weight that should be afforded it, why is there reversible error?
There's reversible error because essentially we think Judge Mulway blew it. She blew her gatekeeping function under Daubert and Kumho Tires and Rule 702. She shouldn't have let him testify. There was an objection, and on abuse of discretion, we argue that she abused her discretion.
So what would be, are you saying that the count that would be affected would be the forfeiture account?
The forfeiture account, the count two, which goes to the $8 million.
Did the chart that you refer yes. to come into evidence?
Yes, this is Exhibit 66.
Was it in the jury room?
I think it was, but I can't say definitively.
Okay.
I'd say the chart shouldn't have come into evidence, but isn't there, you're saying there's still a basis for the expert Chu even testifying as to that information apart from the chart?
We're saying that Chu was completely unreliable in this case, and that he should not have been permitted to testify as an expert.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Pam Tomashiro, and I'm the last one on the calendar, so it should please the court. I represent Defendant Marlene Ogata.
We're always happy to have you, even if you're last.
And she, there is just one issue in her appeal, that is the sentencing court's denial of a mitigating role adjustment. I think the government and the defense agrees on one point, and that is that Ms. Ogata did have the burden of proof at the hearing to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that she was entitled to a minor role adjustment. And basically, you know, I've briefed it, and you know, we pointed out to the fact, and may I just point out that unlike the other three defendants, although Ms. Ogata was charged in the same indictment, she pled guilty, no plea agreement, just count one, and so only sentencing, that is the sole issue here. You know, factually, we pointed out that the government argued this was the largest meth ring ever in the state of Hawaii. Over 2,000 pounds, 24 participants over a five-year period. That was the overall outline of the government's case regarding this particular case. And so we argued that Ms. Ogata, one of the 24 participants, she was the pre-sentence report attributed 50 pounds of generic methamphetamine to her, which comprises 2.5% of the entire quantity of drugs that was distributed by the conspiracy.
And she got a couple $100,000 out of the deal, is that right?
Yes, she did get a couple $100,000.
So I guess the real question is on this, whether she's substantially less culpable. I guess your benchmarking that against the size of the deal overall. Is that the
foundation? That is correct. And Judge, I would just point out that, you know, based upon the Wilson case, on a minor role adjustment, it is just that the defendant is less culpable, than most of the participants. It doesn't have any substantially or any other type of modifier. It is just that the defendant is less culpable than most of the participants. And
she delivered drugs?
She was a go-between between her ex-boyfriend Wayne Keela and Sherry Bullockon and or Mr. Rainey. And so her participation was limited to three transactions only with this Mr. Wayne Keela. And that was part of our argument. She was incarcerated during a year of the alleged time of the conspiracy, so we argued that her participation was less than most participants. And then throughout the trial and throughout the PSR, her role is described as a middle person, a facilitator, an intermediary, a go-between.
But she delivered drugs and sent money back, right?
No. What she did was, I believe, Wayne Keela would call her, say, I need X amount of drugs. She would then call Sherry Bullockon, who was her girlfriend, and Sherry would deliver it. Ms. Bullockon was present, I believe, on one occasion when some 7 or 8 pounds was delivered at her home. Another time it occurred at a hotel. Although she was present in a different hotel room, she was not there when the drugs actually changed hands. And I can't remember the exact, but there was a third transaction with Mr. Keela. And I can't remember if she was actually present at that time. But basically, I mean, those were the reasons. I mean, you know, they're not factually what we argued, that she was entitled to a minor role adjustment. And based upon the relatively low standard that Ms. Ogata had to prove this minor role adjustment, that is, by a preponderance of the evidence, we believe that Judge Mulway should have granted her the minor role adjustment.
Could you just go back on, rewind on one item,
okay.
And that was the use of whether the case law has infused substantially less culpable, and you said no, that's not the case, and I just wanted to hear that again from you.
In my reply brief on page 3, I'll talk about the distinction between a minimal role and a minor role adjustment. Mm-hmm. In United States v. Wilson, what the court did in that case was excise language that applied, which they decided should apply only to the minimal role adjustment.
And not to the minor role.
That's correct.
Okay, that's what I thought you said. I just wanted to make sure I understood you correctly.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you.
With your permission, could I, before the governor
sure.
comes, could I follow up one question with Ms. McLeod?
Yes, Your Honor.
I was curious about your argument where you said you're asking us to remand the issue regarding the enhancement, because that was not in your briefing. To remand the issue regarding the pre-sentence report in paragraph 32?
The 2D1.1B1 enhancement?
You said we were questioning you regarding whether or not there was an objection to that paragraph.
Correct.
And we were discussing that the district court could have had the opportunity to have the government bring in the witness.
Correct.
If that had been done. And you
right.
said that you're asking for a remand. And I'm asking you, in your briefing, did you ever request a remand for the district court to resolve the factual dispute?
I thought that was what I requested in argument sections 1 and 2, and maybe
point me to the language in your brief where you ask us to remand this for the court to resolve the factual dispute regarding whether or not Ms. Tavares had correctly identified the date.
Let me suggest this. Why don't you sit down
and
do
that,
and she's going to come back, but it's
okay.
It's an important question. So why don't you sit down and look for that? You're going to have a chance to come back, and we'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Mark N. C. Young for the United States.
Were you the trial counsel?
I was, Your Honor. I was with co-counsel Claire Connors. I'll begin. I'll just follow the same order that the issues were presented by defense counsel, if the court doesn't mind. So beginning first with Mr. Olguin and the gun enhancement question. The simple fact of the matter is there was no factual objection to that by trial counsel. The district court specifically asked, are you objecting simply because there was no trial evidence or trial testimony on this issue? And the answer was yes. So at that point, she overruled the objection. She said, I adopt the finding of the PSR because there's been no objection. End of story.
Well, that's why we're at plain error review, isn't it? I mean, that happens all the time. Correct. So now we're on plain error review.
Correct.
So now, what about the question I raised regarding from your reading of the briefing on appeal, did you get the sense that Mr. Olguin was asking for a remand for the district court to make the determination as to whether the PSR was correct?
I don't recall specifically reading that, but I assume that was the request. I'll have to say.
So you assume that there would be a remand if this issue was found to have constituted plain error?
Well.
Or even if it wasn't?
I assume that that's what defense counsel was requesting. I didn't assume that there would be a remand.
Right. So now let's get to the underlying. Yeah, we don't know whether there will or there won't be, but the underlying question, though, is the what counsel suggests is that the timing is off on the statement that he wasn't in the conspiracy till 2004, according to the government. You have a 2003 date, and therefore this collision of dates can't support the sentencing. Could you respond to that?
Yeah, let me address that. I mean, I certainly wouldn't characterize it as a collision in the record. I think what happened throughout the trial, and I addressed this, I believe, in my closing argument, was because this conspiracy was over such a substantial time, and because it was a historical investigation, so we were going back in time, the time we were talking to some of these people, many years had passed since the events. So it was very difficult for them to pinpoint certain dates, even years sometimes is when it happened. Because as I think Ms. Bulacan had pointed out, every day was the same. These people got up, they dealt drugs, they got high, they gambled, and then the next day they did it all over again. So there were no, you know, landmarks to say, oh yeah, I remember that happened on this day or that happened on this day. I think it's reaching, to say the least, to say that when Ms. Tavares identified this event.
Let me ask you, did the government take the position that Mr. Olguin entered the conspiracy in 2004?
I frankly don't recall specifying any specific date where, you know, within the time frame where the conspiracy was joined. What I can say is that the conspiracy was obviously well in play if Ms. Tavares was meeting Mr. Olguin and Mr. Kuna, coming back from Hawaii with $130,000 in cash to give them. Obviously, the conspiracy was operating at that point. So whether it was 2003, 2004, I don't think that even matters in the end. We know it was within the confines of the conspiracy. We know that it was in furtherance of the conspiracy. The testimony that Ms. Tavares gave, although she did not testify on that point, she was found to be credible. The district court had the opportunity to observe her, heard her testify during the trial, and although she did not testify on that point, she found her to be a credible witness. I think that can be inferred from the record. And then additionally, when they arrest Mr. Olguin, when the search warrant is executed in 2007, they find a gun. Now, is it the greatest corroboration the government has ever produced? No, but it only need be minimal. The hearsay standard at sentencing is that there only need be minimal reliability.
So your position would be even without the Tavares testimony that a gun found after the conspiracy ended was sufficient?
No, it's not what I'm saying.
Okay,
that's
what I'm asking.
I'm saying that corroborated Ms. Tavares' statement. By itself, no.
Okay.
I would concede if that was by itself. I'll turn next to the sufficiency of the evidence and constructive amendment and variance issues raised by Mr. Kuna. First of all, the standard is the evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to the prosecution. And and to determine whether any rational trier of fact could have found a single conspiracy beyond a reasonable doubt. In this case, Your Honors, the evidence was overwhelming. There were 41 government witnesses presented. 10 of those were co-conspirators, cooperating defendants who had been in the midst of this conspiracy. Those witnesses were corroborated independently, and I'll give some examples in a moment, as well as jointly. Independently, just some quick examples. Obviously, Francis Honda was kind of the defendant that got this case rolling. He identifies Charles Ranney as a source and says, yeah, in fact, he just dropped off a box of 40 pounds of methamphetamine. It's at my friend's house. DEA gets a search warrant. They go to the house. There it is, along with $200,000 in cash. Recorded calls that are made to Mr. Ranney from Mr. Honda, basically acknowledging and confirming what he had said. Further calls are made to another woman, Jonette Quintal, who was sent by Ranney to come to Hawaii to pick up money and take bad, quote, bad drugs, again corroborating it. Then the express mail parcel receipts are unearthed. When they do the search at Mr. Honda's home, they find that all these, the string of express mail parcel boxes sent between Mr. Ranney, Antonio Santos, Brandon Swan, Brenda Yamamoto, all further corroborating it. The financial evidence that we got into, that was at Exhibit 249A, was the summary of all the financial. Nearly $900,000 in unexplained, undocumented income into Ms. Valenzuela's accounts. Then you have what I call the joint corroboration. These 10 or 11 cooperating defendants, co-conspirators, they weren't all arrested at once and interviewed on the same day. This was over a period of years. Charles Ranney was arrested in 2005. Sherry Bulacan was arrested 2 years later in 2007. Yet, they paint the same picture, identify the same players. Then you have Mr. Melendez, Luis Melendez, who was not a member of this conspiracy, but was involved in a separate conspiracy in Las Vegas, where he dealt with Mr. Olguin and Mr. Acuna, and he corroborates what the witnesses in this case said. So for all those reasons, clearly, in the light most favorable to the prosecution, the answer is a resounding yes, that any rational trier of fact would have found that this was a single conspiracy. The argument was made that there was multiple conspiracies. Again, under the Zemek case and the Perry case, those cases stand soundly for the proposition that in any conspiracy, particularly a large conspiracy like this, there are going to be lots and lots and lots of smaller sub-agreements that are required to meet the greater goal, the greater objective that was of this single conspiracy. And that is what the government argued in our closing argument.
Were you the lawyer that told the jury in closing or commented on the refusal of certain defendants to plead guilty?
I was, Your Honor, and I was going to get to that in the next point. And that was a mistake on my part. I went over the line on that comment. It was not something I should have said. In the greater scheme of things, though, in the hour and a half or so that I spoke to the jury, that was a minor point. It did not, I don't believe, detract from.
I think it's minor to comment to lay jurors that defendants taking advantage of their right to a trial by jury are comparing them to people who pled guilty, because that the insiders, the ones who pled, were the heart and soul of your case, right?
Right. No, it's not minor. I didn't mean minor. What I was going to say was minor in all of the evidence that I had presented and all of the things that I talked about in the closing argument, that was not something that was harped on or highlighted or in any way construed to be substantive evidence of their guilt. But no, it is.
Were you the government lawyer that asked Valenzuela's father, quote, is it you who taught your daughter to lie, close quote?
I was not, Your Honor, but I was lead counsel, so I take responsibility for that statement. And again, that was an improper statement. Ms. Connors and I spoke about that at length. She felt very bad about it. She knows that it was not a proper statement. You know, there's no excuse for it. I can't.
Which prosecutor said, I'll bet my life?
That was me. But again, that was, and I hope that the court was able to just discern that that was completely taken out of context. I'm disappointed that it was portrayed the way it was, because I was in no way, and if you look at the record in that, vouching for or talking about the credibility or the honesty of the testimony. What I was talking about was what was in the record, because Valenzuela's trial counsel repeatedly kept misrepresenting the record, saying that Joseph Chai had said that the total amount of methamphetamine that he had shipped was 25 to 75 pounds or 50 to 75 pounds.
But you know, it's inappropriate for you to express any kind of personal view of what the evidence.
Correct. And it was, I did not go about it the right way. I should have just simply
said. The record will reflect.
Right. And that was my bad.
The jury's asked to compare this exhibit and this testimony and this exhibit.
Correct. Yeah. I did not handle that the way I should have, undoubtedly.
Well, let's talk about Exhibit 66, if we might.
Yes.
You know, it's troubling to me that you have an exhibit, the precise source of which is, you know, not fully documented, and that exhibit comes in and somehow it gets blessed because you have a witness saying, well, you know, looks right to me, that's similar to what my experience would be. What is the foundational basis for Exhibit 66 coming into evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I think as with, you know, any other similar information, this is an expert opinion. So our expert, Mr. Chu, Agent Chu, who is an ICE agent currently, had been an FBI agent, had been a U.S. Marshal, had testified previously as an expert on drug value, looked at this, and throughout his, based on his career experience, and...
No, but the evidence, you know, in other words, for an exhibit to come in as a summary exhibit, all the underlying evidence has to be admissible, and then this is a fair summary of that evidence. You don't even have a witness, you don't have a foundational witness for the figures in that testimony, in that exhibit. So that's why there's like a disjunction between the exhibit and the detective or the ICE officer.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I guess if the court is making the distinction that the expert could have testified to this, but the exhibit shouldn't have been actually admitted into evidence, I mean, I don't see that distinction. I mean, as Your Honor pointed out, I don't think if the defense position on this is adopted, you could ever have an expert unless they were there, the one to do the specific, to have firsthand knowledge, hands-on, were the one to do it. And that's just not...
Well, I mean, what if you have a weather expert but you bring in summaries of weather that he didn't have anything to do with preparing, and you don't know how they were prepared or how they were put together, and you've got all the temperatures in Honolulu for the last 20 years, and he said, well, you know, I've been around, that looks right to me. I mean, that wouldn't be admissible. I mean, it's the same thing here. He could say, I've been an expert, in my experience, Honolulu temperature is, or in my experience, drug prices are A, B, and C, but you have this exhibit where we don't even have the underlying data.
But I see, I think to me that's the essence of being an expert. As you said, the expert would say, in my experience, this is what it is. Well, if that now you've said that and now you're looking at this chart and that's consistent, that's what an expert does.
Would there have been a difference in this case if Mr. Chu testified exactly the way he did as an expert, but the chart didn't come into evidence? Would there have been a difference in the outcome of the forfeiture count?
No, because the information that he testified to was, I mean, orally, was the same that was on the chart. And, you know, I think if you look at the chart, if you look at Exhibit 66, I mean, the numbers that are on there are consistent with what the testimony of Sherry Bulacan and Charles Rani were saying, that they were paying for the methamphetamine from Acuna, Valenzuela, and Olguin.
Who prepared the chart?
It was a HIDA, Hawaii Intel analyst, Hawaii High Intensity Drug Trafficking Association Intel.
Did the jury know this?
No.
No. So they had no idea who prepared it?
No.
How it came to be? What the underlying information that led to its creation was?
No, what they knew was that the expert, in his opinion, said that that information was consistent with his experience in drug prices. And if you look at the chart, I mean, the government.
I mean, there's really no rule of evidence that gets you from that testimony to admission of a chart.
Well, and if not, as I said, the evidence was going to be in the record. The Agent Hsu would have testified, still as he did, that $4,000 was the low end, bottom basement price for a pound of methamphetamine coming from Mexico during the time of the conspiracy, which is the number that we use. So we use the most conservative number possible on that chart, if you look at it, the lowest number.
Because expert matters that an expert relies on don't have to be admissible. An expert can testify, he can inform his analysis from information that's not necessarily admissible into evidence.
Well, I think experts are given a certain amount of leeway. Again, he was qualified as an expert. He testified previously. That was based on his years of experience, the things that he specified, interviewing drug defendants, debriefing cooperating defendants, executing.
Right. And all of that didn't have to come in as evidence in order for him to qualify as an expert. So he can base his opinion on information that's not necessarily before the court at that particular time.
Well, I don't know, not before the court, not before the jury, maybe. I
mean, it's not before the court, because he didn't bring in every interview he'd ever done. He didn't.
No, of course not. No, he summarized it, correct, and the court found that based on that summary that he was qualified, as he had testified previously, to be an expert and to offer his
opinion. Did the exhibit go in the jury room?
It was available in a binder with all the other exhibits that went into the jury room, yes.
Sounds like the answer to my question is yes.
Yes.
It was in a binder. The binder went in.
The binder with all the other trial exhibits, correct. Okay.
Right. So save yourself some time and mild irritation of a jurist by simply answering the question yes or no. It's yes.
Well, as far as
this document, the jury had no idea who prepared it, what the basis for its preparation was, and was part of the foundation for the government's claim as to the amount of forfeiture, goes right in the jury room.
Right, which was
for them to consider and rely upon.
Which is what the expert testified to, yes. I'll move to the matter regarding Ms. Ogata, the minor role. The standard of review for this is clear error. As I indicated in my brief, and I think as the district court also agreed, the defendant failed to meet her burden of proof in that, and that is a preponderance of the evidence, but failed to meet the burden of proof to show that she was, in fact, less culpable than most other participants.
You were the chief counsel for this prosecution, and I assume had some supervisory role in the grand jury investigation?
Correct.
How would you compare Ogata's role to, say, Bulacan? Do I pronounce it correctly?
Bulacan, yes.
How would you compare Ogata's role to Bulacan?
She was definitely below Bulacan.
He was a major player?
Ms. Ogata?
No, Bulacan.
Bulacan, oh yes.
She?
She was
a major player.
Yes, absolutely.
And compared to her, was Ogata a minor player?
Compared to Bulacan, but if you compare Ms. Ogata to Francis Honda, Eric Shimomura, Jeanette Quintal, Antonio Santos, Brandon Swan, Brandon Yamamoto, Ronald Shim, Joseph Chai, Donald Dempsey, Guy Sierras, Bobby Gina Sunshin, and Michael Winnings, she was above all those people who were co-conspirators in this case.
Did any of them get 210 months?
I think the closest was Mr. Yamamoto, got 192 months.
Okay.
But I would say that really all you need to know about Ms. Ogata is that she had the wherewithal and had the position to be able to broker a 100-pound meth deal between her friend Wayne Kila and her girlfriend Ms. Bulacan and get paid $2,000 per pound and walk away with $200,000. That is not a minor role player in any conspiracy, drug conspiracy. And so unless there are further questions, I would submit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. McLeod?
Yes.
you can respond on behalf of Mr. Oldwin. You have about a minute and a half.
Thank you, Your Honor. The answer to your question is that I asked for a remand for resentencing, but I did not specify the purpose for resentencing, and that's in my opening brief at the conclusion on page 60, and it's also in the reply brief on the conclusion.
You refined your argument here in terms of the specific issue of the testimony or the of Ms. Tavares on the gun. That was not in your brief regarding whether or not the district court had the opportunity to consider calling in the witness or fleshing out the dates. That wasn't in your briefing.
Your Honor, sections 1 and 2 of my opening brief specifically dealt with the PSR's allegation that there was a gun in 2007 and 2003 and that the 2D1.1B1 enhancement were correct. I dealt with both the 2007 finding and the 2003 citing in the brief. The portion that was not in the brief is the fact that the transcripts and the government argument placed Oldwin in the conspiracy only beginning in 2004. And I would like to give you the cites to the record if you'd like.
I'd like you to give me the cites in the brief where you discussed the point about the government being stopped and the dates being inconsistent. Where did you discuss that in your brief?
Your Honor, what I just said is that that portion was not in the brief. The portion about, I had another objection to the 2003 being considered because it was uncorroborated hearsay under Ponce and Petty and Chunza Plazas that couldn't be considered. What I'm adding at argument is that it's particularly uncorroborated and contradicted by the trial evidence from Rani and Bulacan and from the government placing Oldwin in the conspiracy only in 2004, and specifically from the government argument in their supplemental excerpts of record at 658 about him not being in the conspiracy to 2004, which they needed to do.
It's just helpful if we know the arguments before we come here.
I apologize for that. I would also invite the court's attention to the government's brief on appeal on page 10, where they make the same point about Oldwin not being in the picture until 2004. Again, something that they had to say to rebut this defense, pointing out that he was bankrupt in 2003, so he wasn't in a conspiracy.
Thank you. I think we have your argument in mind.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Acuna and Ms. Valenzuela's counsel used up your time, but I'm gonna, if you would like a minute of rebuttal and you think that would be helpful, I'm happy to provide it. Does Mr. Acuna, do you wanna add anything, sir? Okay. And with respect to Ms. Ogata, Ms. Tamashiro, would you like to add anything else? All right. Okay, with that then, the case of United States versus Acuna et al. Is submitted. I thank counsel for your organization of the argument. These multi-defendant conspiracies are not that easy to argue either for defense counsel or for the government. So I appreciate your argument, and we're adjourned for the morning.
This court for this session stands adjourned.